Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. This is episode 87 of Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers. What do you need to know as a law enforcement officer in the Commonwealth of Virginia to talk to better strengthen and serve your communities? Today, we're talking about three really interesting cases from the courts of appeals, two from the Fourth Circuit and one from the Court of Appeals in Virginia, dismissing lawsuits for police use of force and a police arrest in Virginia. And in Virginia, also in North Carolina, too. And these are all really interesting cases. They all came in the same week, and I think each one kind of bears some analysis for various reasons. We're going to talk about a case from Arlington County where two people who were shot, one was bitten by a dog, they sued law enforcement officers. We're going to talk about a case where a person was taken into custody using a dog in a suicide situation, and he survived and sued the law enforcement officer. And then we're going to talk about a case from North Carolina where an individual was arrested and simply sued the law enforcement officer. And in all three cases, the lawsuit against the police was dismissed in these cases this week. So I think they all have their own lessons, but taken in together too, I think that they also have some good lessons for us as about the courts going forward. So the first case I want to talk about is a pair of lawsuits, and these are the lawsuits are Best versus Farr and Larry versus Farr. And Farr is the chief of police in Arlington County. The lawsuit concerns the Arlington County Police Department, but also the individual officers who engaged in a particular detention and then an arrest of two individuals in Arlington County. And the facts of the case are interesting. So what happens in this case is law enforcement officers were conducting surveillance of a van that they believe may be engaged in drug activity. The passenger in the car had a warrant for her arrest. She had made arrangements to turn herself in the next day. But while she was in the passenger seat and the driver was in the driver's seat, officers observed the driver appear to engage in a hand-to-hand transaction that appeared to involve illicit drugs or an illegal drug transaction. So the officers go to pin in the vehicle. They drive up to sort of pin the vehicle to stop it from driving away. And five armed plainclothes officers drive in these vehicles. Three of the unmarked vehicles box the vehicle in. And when they get out of the car, they go to detain the driver and the passenger. So at this point, we've got to stop and we have to take what the plaintiffs say at their word and when they bring in their lawsuit. So, and why do we do that? Because this case is dismissed at the earliest stage of the litigation, before there's even discovery or anything. It's dismissed at what's called the demurrer stage. The demurrer stage is basically a stage where you say, taking everything that the plaintiffs say in this case to be true, they still could never win. So let's not even do discovery. Let's not even do any investigation into this. Even if everything they say here is true, they couldn't possibly prevail in their lawsuit. So we take what they say as true. We don't look at the officer's perspective. Well, what they say, and we have a video to back this up to some degree, when the officers get out of their vehicles, they're not wearing uniform. They do not display any badges. They don't tell the plaintiffs that they're under arrest, according to the plaintiffs. What they do is they get out of the car and they start pulling on the window, pulling on the doors and saying, show me your hands, show me your hands. The officers have firearms. And one of the officers, they're yelling at them. At that point, the driver panics, tries to escape. He pulls forward, he strikes one police officer's vehicle, and then he backs up and strikes another police officer's vehicle, pushes it backwards, and that gets the vehicle to be able to escape. The van starts to accelerate, and in doing so, drives straight at a police officer, who then has to jump out of the way. And officers draw and fire repeatedly, striking the driver five times and the passenger one time. The driver survives, as does the passenger. The driver drives a short distance, but he's been shot five times. He's not going to make it very far. So he comes to a stop, and the plaintiff runs, and she hides. She runs and hides. Police send a police dog after her, and the dog finds her and bites her. Both of them arrested. Both of them go to the hospital. They are both treated, and they both survive and sue the police officers. So again, all these facts are the facts that they allege. We don't look to what the officer's perspective is, because at this stage, the case has been dismissed without any kind of discovery or trial or anything like that. So the case goes to the Virginia Court of Appeals to consider whether the case was properly dismissed. And in and of itself, I think that's really interesting as a lawyer, because we don't really have a lot of use of force law from the Virginia Court of Appeals. Traditionally, the Court of Appeals hasn't taken civil case appeals. That used to be the job of the Virginia Supreme Court. And at that, the Virginia Supreme Court only took a couple of cases a year. They would not, they usually didn't decide to hear a lot of cases each year. But we switched over a couple of years ago in Virginia to an appeal of right system. And in when we switched over to this system, all criminal cases went to the Court of Appeals for an appeal. And civil litigants also now got access to the Court of Appeals as well. So they added a few Court of Appeals judges. And now we have this decision from the Virginia Court of Appeals in this civil case. We never would have had this before. So it's one of the first times the Court of Appeals has really had to deal with police use of force lawsuits. How are they going to come out in this case? Well, the first, you know, they analyze it the way they would analyze any other case. And they start out by saying, you know, the officers, when they come up on the vehicle, are they lawfully stopping the vehicle? That's the first question we have to answer. And here the court looks at it and says, yeah, this stop is supported by reasonable suspicion, and therefore it's lawful, right? That the standard for law enforcement authority to make a stop is very low. Reasonable suspicion is a very low standard. But here the court looks at the fact that the officers see what they believe to be a hand-to-hand drug transaction based on their training and experience. And so the officers here, the court finds, did lawfully stop the plaintiffs. It doesn't matter that ultimately there's no drug charges that are brought. That doesn't prove anything about whether the officers had lawful authority to conduct an investigative detention. Now, when the officers come up on the vehicle, then they activate their lights, their blue lights in the vehicle, and ultimately, you know, they have this confrontation where the vehicle starts to crash into the officers, and then it drives at the officers and crashes and flees. So the crux of the argument here is, from the plaintiffs, is these officers didn't sufficiently identify themselves as law enforcement officers. And the implication, therefore, is that they didn't know that they were dealing with the police. But here, the Court of Appeals doesn't accept that. Number one, the Court of Appeals, you know, points out, at no point do the plaintiffs actually say, we didn't know this was the police. In fact, they sort of scrupulously avoid saying that exact phrase, because it's pretty clear they did know that it was the police. In addition, the court says any reasonable person would have known in this case that it was a police because, for one thing, the police vehicles flashed blue lights on them, emergency lights. The officers, when they get out, order the plaintiffs to show their hands. And the court says, well, that's what police officers say. They, you know, show me your hands is something police officers say. And in addition, they point out that both the plaintiff and the passenger knew that the passenger had outstanding warrants, which indicated the police were probably looking for them. So they knew that the police were looking for them. But again, I think the court found most significant the fact that they don't actually say at any point, we didn't know this was the police. They just sort of say, well, the police didn't adequately identify themselves to make their use of force lawful. But the court points out here, at this point, the officers have just jumped out and said, show me your hands, show me your hands. It's then at that point that the plaintiff starts crashing into these vehicles. Boom, crashes into the front one, backs up, boom, crashes in the second one. Then third, drives at the police officer, nearly striking the officer, causing the officer to have to jump out of the way. And the court here says, these officers, it's not as if they're using lawful self-defense. You cannot, in Virginia, the court repeats here, use force to repel an investigative detention, even if that investigative detention ends up being something declared to be unlawful. And that's interesting, right? Because in Virginia, you can use force to repel a unlawful arrest. In fact, the court in this case cites a case called Foote versus Commonwealth, which if you've been one of my class before, I talk about sometimes. And Foote was a case going back to the days when officers had to be wearing uniform badge of authority in order to effect an arrest. And in Foot, a deputy sees Mr. Foot, who's wanted, and he chases after him in his personal vehicle, an unmarked vehicle, much like this case. He chases Foot up a mountain road. Foot then stops his vehicle and jumps out. The deputy pulls his firearm and says, "Hey, Foot, you're under arrest." Foot grabs a firearm. He points it back at the officer. The officer then shoots at Foot, so Foot shoots back. More officers show up. Foot runs out of ammunition and surrenders. And he's charged with attempted capital murder of a police officer. But there, in that case, the court said, well, in that case, the deputy wasn't wearing uniform badge of authority, and therefore, under the code at the time, 19281, he couldn't lawfully arrest Mr. Foot. And the court said, therefore, when you pointed your gun at Mr. Foot could point a gun back. When you shot at Mr. Foot could shoot back. Because you were making an unlawful arrest, and Foot could respond accordingly. So Foot's still good law. That's still good law in Virginia. I mean, that's a case from 1990. Here we are 33 years later, and Foot is still good law. But in this case, the court says this is not an arrest. This is an investigative detention. And the court many years ago in a case called Commonwealth versus Hill about 20 years ago said, even if you have the right to resist an unlawful arrest, you don't have the right to resist an unlawful detention. So in this case, because the plaintiffs in this case didn't have the right to resist any kind of unlawful detention, what they do essentially is, you know, unlawfully put the officers in danger by crashing other cars and trying to run them over. And here then the officers' use of deadly force in response to the efforts to run them over and flee, the court finds was lawful. The court also finds that the use of a police dog ultimately to capture the passenger, in addition, was a use of reasonable force under the circumstances, given the kind of force that the plaintiffs used as well. In that way, you know, this case is very similar to a U.S. Supreme Court case called Plumhoff versus Rickard. And that's a case where they go to stop Mr. Rickard and his passenger, Kelly Allen, they end up crashing into the police box them in. And they crash into the police cars repeatedly and ultimately break free of the officers who are pinning them in. They take and drive directly at one of the officers. Officers jump out of the way. The officers draw and fire. They end up, Sergeant Plumhoff ends up killing Mr. Rickard and the passenger. So both the passenger and the driver in that case were killed. But in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court found that, again, because the use of deadly force by the plaintiffs in that case against the officers justified their response of using deadly force. The court found that that was a lawful use of force, and that case was properly dismissed prior to trial. In Plumhoff versus Rickard, actually, the lower courts had said that the case should go to trial, that the officers used excessive force and, in fact, specifically criticized the officers for having chased after Mr. Rickard and also for having shot at Mr. Rickard too many times. But in both of those, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected both of those arguments, saying if you're justified in shooting, you're justified in shooting until the threat is over. And it's not the police's job just to give up on chasing after people. That's not what the police are supposed to do. So here again, the officer's initial stop was lawful. Here, even if the officers didn't identify themselves sufficiently, that's not what causes them to use deadly force. And so the court finds that the force in this case is lawful and dismisses the lawsuit. The other thing that's interesting, too, is the court looks at the potential for the chief of police and the police department to be liable and says there's nothing in this case that's adequately alleged that the police department here did anything wrong in training the officers or anything like that. The second case I want to look at is a case called Putnam versus Harris. And this is a case, again, from Virginia. This is the Western District of Virginia. And this is a case where police respond to a suicidal individual, a person named Mr. Putnam. Mr. Putnam had sent text to his wife earlier that day stating he had a gun in his mouth. Don't come to the house. I'd rather not somebody find me. The wife went there, didn't find him, called 911, said, hey, look, my husband, he regularly drinks alcohol. He owns firearms. Please go looking for him. I think he's either killed himself already or going to kill himself. So police respond. They find a rifle in the house, but they don't find Mr. Putnam. There are woods all around the property, so they go into the woods and they bring a canine with them, a canine unit. So they walk through and they soon find Mr. Putnam using the dog. When they find him, they can see empty beer cans, they can smell alcohol. They tell him to get up, put your hands up, but he's intoxicated and he's on his property, and he yells back at the officers, "Hands up for what? This is my property. I'm not getting up. I live here. Like, hey man, you know, get up. You don't want to get bit by the dog. You know, face away from us. You're going to get bit by the dog if you don't comply." And he says, "You can't put that dog on me. If that dog bites me, I'm going to effing sue." And they said, "You know, show me your warrant. What are you doing here on my property?" So, "We don't need to have a warrant." And he said, "F you don't. If your dog bites me, I'm going to sue you." They say, "Turn around, put your hands up. For what? I haven't done anything wrong. You said you're going to kill yourself." "No, I didn't." "Yeah, you did. Where's the gun? Show us the gun. Where is the gun?" He says, "What gun? I don't have a gun." And he lifts up his shirt to show that he has nothing in his waistband, but he won't turn around, so they can't see behind his back. They say, turn around. He says, "No, I'm not going to turn around. Show me your warrant. This is my property. Get off my property." They say, "Put your hands behind your back." He says, I'm not going to do it. He lifts his shirt again, but they can't see behind his back. He said, "One more time, if you do not comply, you're going to get bit by the dog." And he keeps saying, For what? What did I do?" At that point, they release the dog. The dog ends up biting him, and he surrenders. The bite causes him some severe damage to his brachial artery. A surgeon has to harvest a vein from his leg to repair it. And he sues the law enforcement officer for an excessive use of force. Here, the court examines the facts of this case, and they say that the officers had probable cause for a mental health seizure and reasonable belief that the plaintiff posed an immediate threat based upon the facts that are alleged here in the case. And so the court said the use of the dog was lawful because there was an immediate safety risk that was reasonably likely to be cured by using the dog, and therefore the deployment of the dog was lawful. Here in this case, the court said, as long as there are facts from which a reasonable officer could conclude that the resistance poses some immediate danger despite its nonviolent character, that force is warranted. And in this case, the court looks at the facts and they say, well, look at the text that the plaintiff had sent to his wife. Look at the fact that he owns firearms, the fact that he's intoxicated. Then you have this heated argument. He's, you know, moving around erratically. He's waving his arms. He's refusing to face away from the officers. Here, the officers, in the eyes of the court, concluded the officers could reasonably fear that that Mr. Putnam had a hidden gun and was a threat of deadly force. The court found that the officer's belief that he had a firearm, even though they never saw one, was an objectively reasonable conclusion, and so deploying the dog in the eyes of the court was lawful. Here, you know, the court noted that this case, it compared this case to a case called Young versus Prince George's County. And that's an interesting case to compare this case to. In Young versus Prince George's County, that's a case where Prince George's County police officers stopped an off-duty FBI agent in Prince George's County. He was stopped for some traffic violation. And he told the officers, "Hey, look, I'm an off-duty law enforcement officer. I have a firearm." And so the officers get him out of the car. They put him in handcuffs. They throw him down on the ground. They disarm him. And in that case, the Fourth Circuit said, look, officers can block in his vehicle because they, you know, have a legitimate safety concern. They can draw their weapons when they're confronted with a passenger who may have a weapon himself. They can put him in handcuffs. They can disarm him. All of these things are reasonable during the course of a traffic stop. It doesn't turn it into arrest. These are all reasonable officer safety actions, including putting him on the ground. When the officers putting him on the ground was a reasonable officer safety action. But in this case, not only put him on the ground, but the allegation was that the officer struck him in the back of the head with his forearm and pounded his knee into his back. In this case, the court said, "Well, I mean, what's the reason for that?" In the Young case, the court said he'd never done anything aggressively. He never threatened anybody. He just said, "I'm an off-duty FBI agent and I have a firearm," and that's the only thing that he did. And here the officers put him in handcuffs, throw him on the ground, and then strike him. the court says, well, striking him is something that you don't have authority to do unless you believe you have some threat or some resistance, some reason to use force. In this case, though, the court says, look, in Putnam, the case where the defendant is not complying with commands and the officers fail to believe he's armed, and that makes it reasonable for the officers to use this dog. It's interesting because the court says, in this case, as they did in so many other cases, watches the body camera footage. And the body camera footage is very important to the officers, to the court. But in addition, the court also looks at the facts of the case as well. The last case I want to talk about here is another lawsuit against a law enforcement officer, and this is a case called Torres versus Ball. This is a case from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Western District of North Carolina. So Fourth Circuit again. This isn't a use of force lawsuit. This is a case where Mr. Torres had several outstanding warrants, and a law enforcement officer gets a tip from an informant that that Mr. Torres is driving a dark green Honda with dark tinted windows and could be located at a particular address. So the officer corroborates the fact that these warrants are outstanding, and he gets this information from the informant. And then about 4 days later, the officer is driving about 3 o'clock in the morning and sees a dark green Honda Accord, the exact same make, model, and color vehicle that the CI says that the appellant is driving, parked in the driveway of a house at the exact address where the CI said that that Mr. Torres had been staying. And he's walking around the vehicle. He can see somebody walking around the vehicle. It's a male. He can't identify who it is, but the male gets into a vehicle and drives away. So the officer follows him until to another address. And then when that vehicle pulls into that other address, he turns on his lights, he calls in the traffic stop, he reports the license plate, and he shines his flashlight draws his firearm and says, show me your hands, show me your hands. He ultimately then takes the driver into custody, and when he takes him into custody, says, hey, do you have any outstanding warrants? And Mr. Torres says, not that I know of. Which, you know, in my experience is pretty much, you know, it's the closest thing to, yes, I have a warrant out for me that you'll see out there in the world. And I think for my law enforcement listeners, you're used to that. The phrase, if you're asked, do you have any warrants? If the answer is not that I know of, then the answer is probably yes, you do. That's not advice. That's just, you know, something I've noticed before. The officer then looks at him and says, oh yeah, this is the guy in the picture that I saw who was wanted. He calls in the vehicle comes back as stolen, they search the car, they find some drug paraphernalia in the car, and they search the defendant, and they find methamphetamine and heroin. So the officer gets a bunch of warrants for Mr. Torres, and Mr. Torres is also served with his outstanding warrants for breaking and entering and felony larceny after breaking and entering. And those are the warrants that he already had outstanding for him. But the charges that the officer brings for Mr. Torres for the arrest that night, those charges never get brought. The lab never tests the substances. The defendant ends up entering a plea agreement, and the state dismisses most of the charges that he gets from that night. So Mr. Torres sues the law enforcement officer, alleging that he was unlawfully arrested by the officer. And the officer moves for the case to be dismissed before trial. They look at the body camera footage and the arrest report and so on. And here the district court dismisses the lawsuit before trial. So the Fourth Circuit's going to look at this case on appeal. And the basic argument here that Mr. Torres makes is that the officer didn't identify him as the driver before he took him into custody and put handcuffs on him, before he brings the traffic stop out. And the officer should have confirmed his identity before making the traffic stop. But here the court says, look, the CI gives details about the make, model, color, and a specific feature, the dark tinted windows of the vehicle. He gives a specific address where he can locate him. And the officer drives up and sees somebody at that address with that exact vehicle. He knew that Mr. Torres had an extensive criminal history. He knew he had several outstanding warrants, four felony offenses. And the court finds that the corroborating aspects of the tip sufficiently established the informant's reliability, and so the totality of the circumstances provided him with sufficient justification to conduct a traffic stop. And so the court says, you know, he'd seen a photograph of him before. He knew he could recognize him eventually if he saw him face to face. And so when he gets out of his vehicle and takes him into custody, the court says that was lawful in this case. So three different cases. And I just want to kind of reflect for a minute about what these cases mean and sort of where to put them in the context of use of force lawsuits. And I think that the case from the Court of Appeals, the Putnam versus Harris case, I think is really interesting because it's the first real use of force lawsuit that we've had from the Court of Appeals in a long time. And what I think is really interesting about the Court of Appeals case, particularly, is that in this case, the panel, which were judges Malvo, Fulton, and White, go back to use of force lawsuits from 1928 and from 1970, cases where not just lawsuits but criminal cases, to get their analysis. One of the cases they cite is a case called Mercer versus Commonwealth, which is a case from 1928 where two game and inland fishery officers were tried for murder when they shot and killed two people who were illegally hunting. And the court looks back at some of that language to talk about law enforcement officers' authority. That was a case where the court in 1928 really struggled with how do you evaluate law enforcement officers' use of deadly force when they are the ones who bring about the aggressor. You know, usually in Virginia, you don't have a duty to retreat if you're engaging in pure self-defense. But if you're the person who caused the difficulty, who brought on the fight, then you have to engage in imperfect self. Then you do have a duty to retreat. You do have to make your desire for peace known. Otherwise, you're responsible. You can't just call on self-defense if you're the one who kind of started it. But here, the court says you can't expect you can't apply that standard to law enforcement officers. Here, officers, in the performance of their duty, the court explained, stand on an entirely different footing from an individual. They are of necessity the aggressor, and so the law gives them special legal protection that's different from normal people because they have a duty to perform, and so they have a protection so long as they keep within the bounds of the law. So when they're resisted by another person, they can use the usual rights of self-defense to protect themselves, but that's not normal self-defense that you would normally get as an average citizen, right? Because as necessity, they're also an aggressor. And I think the fact that the Court of Appeals relies on that case for the proposition that if law enforcement officers use their authority and use it within the bounds of the law, that they're going to get legal protection, I think that that's a really interesting statement by the Court of Appeals for sort of their first big case. The other case that they talk about is a case called Parker versus McCoy, which is a civil lawsuit against a law enforcement officer from Newport News, where an officer walked into a pool hall on orders from his commanding officer to go make a check of the area because there had been fights in these beer halls. So he's going to check it out. And so he walked in, and the guy who ran the pool room said, "What are you doing in here?" And he said, "Just checking." And he said, "Well, if you're not looking at anybody, get out." And he says, "I'm not leaving until I check the place out." So he gets in an argument with the owner. He goes to arrest him for disorderly conduct. He hits him a few times with a blackjack, which was a thing. If you don't know what that is, that's a thing police officers used to carry around. The court here, then they get into a real serious fight. And ultimately, the bar owner knocks the officer to the ground with a pool cue. He's arrested for disorderly conduct. And ultimately, the court looks at it and says, what are the rights of an officer? Are they just the same as a regular citizen? And the court says, well, no, you're not like an ordinary citizen. An ordinary citizen, you could just grab and throw out of your pool hall. But here, a law enforcement officer has legal responsibilities and legal rights to enter establishments and conduct, you know, lawful investigations. Calling an officer a trespasser and using the kind of force that you'd use against a trespasser, it's not the same here, right? And so the court approves of a jury instruction in this case that an officer making an arrest under lawful authority is within the reasonable limits the use of force under the circumstances, if he's acting within the reasonable limits of the use of force under the circumstances, he cannot be found guilty of a wrong unless he arbitrarily abuses the power conferred upon him. In other words, if the officer uses reasonable force, then that's not unlawful for him to do that. The officer had wanted to give a jury instruction that said the court instructs the jury that a peace officer in making arrest is presumed to act in good faith as to the extent of the force employed and is primarily judge of force to be used under the circumstances, that he's the one who gets to decide how much force to use. And here the court says that's not a correct statement of the law. You can't do that. So even back in 1970, we're having arguments about good faith versus reasonable use of force. And here the court cites to both of those cases. In our case, in the Arlington case, talking about, you know, officers are restricted to a reasonable use of force, but if they do use reasonable force, they are protected under the law. So three really good cases for law enforcement, three good rulings for law enforcement officers in 1 week. A little unusual to see cases from the Court of Appeals, but I hope today was interesting. I hope these cases were helpful to you. And check out other podcast episodes if you haven't before. This is episode 87. We got lots of use of force lawsuits. We got lots of search and seizure episodes. We got lots more episodes to come. So for today, though, that's all from Big E. That's all from me. Stay safe and don't get captured.